A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been visiting Mitzpah Ramon, down in the Negev, and came across the ruins of a Nabataean city just outside town, on a hilltop. He went through a frankincense phase a while back, and now he's circling back to the people who moved it. Who were the Nabataeans, really? And how did they fit into the religious landscape of the ancient Near East when they were at their peak?
This is one of those questions where the answer is so much stranger and more interesting than what most people pick up on a tour. The Nabataeans are usually reduced to desert traders who carved pretty buildings, and that's like describing Rome as a city with good plumbing.
Carved pretty buildings and then vanished, which is the part that always gets me. Civilizations that just evaporate.
Except they didn't vanish. They got absorbed, their language got replaced, their trade routes got taken over, but Nabataean bloodlines and architectural DNA are still all over the region. The frankincense thing is the thread to pull, but it's almost a distraction from who they actually were.
Start with the basics. Give me the frame.
The Nabataeans emerge as a distinct power around the 4th or 3rd century BCE, and they're at their peak from roughly the 2nd century BCE through the 1st century CE. Their kingdom stretched from the northern Hejaz in what's now Saudi Arabia, up through southern Jordan, the Negev, and at times into southern Syria. The capital was Petra, but they had a string of cities along the incense route, Avdat, the one near Mitzpah Ramon, plus Mamshit, Haluza, Shivta. These weren't just trading posts. They were sophisticated desert cities with water systems that still work.
The water thing. I've heard about this.
It's genuinely staggering. The Nabataeans built dams, cisterns, and underground channels across the Negev that could capture even a few millimeters of rainfall and channel it into storage. At Avdat, they carved channels into the rock to direct every drop of runoff into cisterns. The annual rainfall in that area is about 80 millimeters. And they supported the city. They grew grapes. They made wine.
Wait. They were making wine in the Negev on 80 millimeters of rain?
Not just making it. Archaeologists have found Nabataean wine presses and amphorae all over the Mediterranean. They weren't just middlemen moving other people's goods. They had their own agricultural production in one of the driest places on Earth, and they turned a profit on it.
That feels like the kind of thing that should be more famous. You hear about Roman aqueducts constantly. Nobody talks about Nabataean water systems.
The Romans conquered them eventually, and Roman historians wrote the history. But the Nabataeans were not some scrappy little tribe that got lucky with the spice trade. They were a kingdom that outmaneuvered everyone around them for centuries through a combination of trade dominance, diplomatic savvy, and an almost supernatural ability to live where nobody else could.
Let's talk about what they were trading. You mentioned frankincense, but that's just the headliner.
Frankincense and myrrh were the big two, and they both came from southern Arabia and the Horn of Africa. Frankincense is the dried resin of boswellia trees, which grow in what's now Oman, Yemen, and Somalia. Myrrh comes from camphora trees in roughly the same region. Both were burned in temples across the Mediterranean and the Near East, Egyptian rites, Greek temples, Roman imperial cult, and of course the temple in Jerusalem. The demand was enormous and constant.
Because you can't do a sacrifice without incense.
Virtually every religious tradition in the ancient Mediterranean used incense in ritual. The smoke was the medium that carried prayers upward. So you have an entire civilization's religious infrastructure dependent on a product that only grows in one corner of the world and has to be transported thousands of kilometers across desert.
That's a good business to be in.
It's a spectacular business to be in because you're not just selling a commodity, you're selling a religious necessity. The demand is inelastic. Temples will pay whatever it costs.
The Nabataeans controlled the transport.
They controlled the transport, the warehousing, the taxation, and eventually a lot of the retail. The incense route started in what's now Oman and Yemen, went up the western edge of Arabia, and then split. One branch went north through Petra to Gaza, where it hit the Mediterranean and got shipped to Greece and Rome. Another went northeast toward Damascus and Mesopotamia. The Nabataeans sat at the choke points.
They touched everything that moved.
And they also controlled the secret of where the sources were. Greek and Roman writers had all kinds of wild theories about where incense came from. Herodotus thought frankincense trees were guarded by flying snakes. The Nabataeans were perfectly happy to let those stories circulate. The mystery inflated the price. If you don't know where it comes from, you can't cut out the middleman. And the Nabataeans were the ultimate middlemen.
That's the economic picture. What about who they actually were?
That's where it gets murky in an interesting way. The Nabataeans were originally an Arab people. Their language was a dialect of Aramaic, but their names, their deities, and their earliest inscriptions all point to Arabian origins. They probably started as nomadic pastoralists in the northern Arabian desert, and then they settled down and built a kingdom.
They're Arabs, but they're writing in Aramaic.
Aramaic was the lingua franca of the Near East by that point. The Persians had used it as an administrative language, and it stuck. The Nabataeans used a distinctive cursive form of Aramaic that eventually evolved into the Arabic script. Yeah, this is one of those connections that doesn't get enough attention. The Nabataean cursive script is the direct ancestor of the Arabic alphabet. If you look at the letter forms side by side, the evolution is clear. So when you're reading Arabic today, you're looking at a writing system that traces back to these desert traders.
That's a remarkable legacy. They gave us the alphabet that a billion plus people use.
Nobody knows it. The Nabataeans are invisible in popular history, but their fingerprints are everywhere.
Okay, so let's get to the religious question. What did the Nabataeans themselves believe?
The Nabataean religion was a form of pre-Islamic Arabian polytheism. Their chief deity was Dushara, whose name means Lord of the Mountain, or Lord of the Shara Mountains, the range around Petra. He was a sky god associated with eagles and mountain peaks. They also worshipped a goddess called Al-Uzza, associated with the planet Venus, and a god called Al-Kutba, a god of writing and knowledge.
A god of writing? For a trading civilization, that makes sense.
They needed scribes. Record-keeping was the backbone of their commercial empire. Al-Kutba is interesting because his name shares a root with the Arabic word kitab, meaning book. These deities show up across pre-Islamic Arabia. They're not unique to the Nabataeans. Dushara and Al-Uzza survived in some form until the rise of Islam. The Quran mentions Al-Uzza by name. The Nabataeans also practiced a distinctive form of worship that didn't involve cult statues in the way Greek and Roman religion did. They represented Dushara with a simple rectangular stone block, a betel.
Like standing stones.
Very much like the Massaboth in early Israelite religion. The Nabataeans would carve niches into cliffs and place these betels inside, and that was the focus of worship. They didn't build temples in the Greco-Roman sense until later when they started Hellenizing.
That Hellenization is the key to understanding how they fit into the broader religious world, right?
The Nabataeans were syncretists. They had to be. Their entire economy depended on moving goods through multiple cultural and religious zones. So when they encountered Greek culture, they started identifying Dushara with Zeus. Inscriptions from the Hellenistic period call him Zeus Dushara. When they encountered the Romans, he became associated with Jupiter and with Dionysus.
The Dionysus connection is interesting.
Probably because of the wine. The Nabataeans were serious vintners, and Dionysus was the god of wine. There's also a theory that Dushara had a dying and rising aspect, a fertility cycle which maps onto Dionysus pretty neatly.
You've got an Arab sky god being worshipped as Zeus, Dionysus, in a city carved out of rock in what's now Jordan, funded by incense that came from Yemen.
That's the ancient world in a sentence. It's not clean categories, it's layers of cultural adaptation.
Here's the question. Daniel's really asking, how did they interact with the specifically Jewish religious world? The Maccabees, the temple, all of that?
The relationship between the Nabataeans and the Jews of the Hasmonean period was complicated, and it swung between alliance and warfare. The Nabataeans and the Maccabees actually started out as allies. In the 2nd century BCE, when the Hasmoneans were fighting the Seleucids, the Nabataeans were happy to provide support, because the Seleucids were a threat to Nabataean trade interests too.
The enemy of my enemy.
1st Maccabees mentions friendly relations between Judas Maccabeus and the Nabataeans, but that didn't last. Once the Hasmoneans consolidated power and started expanding, Alexander Janaeus in particular, they came into direct conflict with the Nabataeans over territory in the Negev and Transjordan. There was a major battle around 90 BCE where the Nabataean king Obodas I defeated Alexander Janaeus in the Golan. The Nabataeans actually deified Obodas after his death and built a temple to him at Avdat, the site Daniel visited.
The city near Mitzpah Ramon. That's the one.
Avdat is named after Obodas. The Nabataeans called it Oboda. And the temple there was dedicated to the deified king. So when you're walking around those ruins, you're looking at a cult of a king who defeated a Jewish army.
That must have made for some interesting local dynamics.
The thing is, by the 1st century BCE and the 1st century CE, the relationship shifted again. The Nabataeans and the Herodian dynasty had extensive ties. Herod the Great's mother was Nabataean. She was a Nabataean princess named Cypros.
Herod was half Nabataean.
His father Antipater was an Idumean, his mother was Nabataean, and Herod maintained close ties with the Nabataean court throughout his reign. He visited Petra, he sent his sons to be educated there. When he had a falling out with Cleopatra and Mark Antony, he had to walk a very careful line between Rome and his Nabataean connections.
The king who rebuilt the temple in Jerusalem was half Arab.
That's not a footnote. That's central to understanding what Judea was in that period. It was not a sealed-off Jewish enclave. It was a crossroads kingdom with deep ties to the surrounding Arab world. Herod's court was multilingual, Aramaic, Hebrew, Greek, Nabataean, Arabic. The cultural boundaries were porous.
What about on the religious level? Were Nabataeans present in Jerusalem? Did they interact with the temple?
There were almost certainly Nabataean merchants in Jerusalem, and there's evidence that Nabataeans offered sacrifices at the temple. The temple was a massive consumer of frankincense. The incense offering was a daily ritual requiring pure frankincense. The Mishnah specifies the exact composition of the incense mixture, and frankincense was one of the key ingredients.
The Nabataeans were literally supplying the raw material for Jewish worship,
profiting from it. That frankincense came through Nabataean hands. There's a direct line from the Boswellia trees of Oman to the Holy of Holies, and the Nabataeans were every link in the chain.
That's a fascinating dependency. The spiritual life of Jerusalem depended on Arabian trade networks.
Everyone knew it. The rabbinic literature mentions Nabataeans, they're called Nabataeans, or sometimes Arabs, and the attitude is mixed. On the one hand, they're respected as traders and sometimes as neighbors. On the other hand, there's suspicion. The Mishnah has a passage about not buying wine or vinegar from Nabataean merchants because of concerns about idolatrous libations.
The religious boundary was real, but commerce crossed it constantly.
As it always does. And here's another layer. By the 1st century CE, a significant number of Nabataeans were converting to Judaism. This is well attested. The Hasmoneans had forcibly converted the Idumeans and the Etrurians to Judaism earlier, and there's evidence of voluntary conversions among Nabataeans, especially in border regions. Josephus mentions Nabataean converts. The Talmud discusses the status of Nabataean converts. It was a live issue.
You have this Arab trading kingdom that's polytheistic, gradually Hellenizing, interacting with a Jewish world that is itself deeply divided. Pharisees, Sadducees, Essenes, all the sectarian ferment of the late Second Temple period. And they're not just neighbors. They're marrying into each other's royal families, converting, trading, fighting.
That's exactly the picture. And it's why the question of how the Nabataeans fit into the religious milieu is almost the wrong framing. They didn't fit into it. They were part of it. The religious world of the ancient Near East in that period wasn't a set of sealed containers. It was a spectrum.
When we talk about the religious groups that were in this part of the world, the Nabataeans are one node in a network that included the Jerusalem Temple establishment, the Samaritan community, the various Jewish sects, the Greek cults in the Decapolis cities, the remnants of Canaanite and Phoenician religion, and eventually the rise of Christianity.
Islam later, which explicitly acknowledged and then superseded the Nabataean religious world. The Nabataean deities are named and rejected in the Quran. The Nabataean script evolved into the Arabic script that the Quran was written in. There's a continuity that's uncomfortable for people who want clean civilizational breaks.
The clash of civilizations. Model doesn't survive contact with the actual archaeology.
It never does. The Nabataeans are a case study in how real civilizations work. They borrow, they adapt, they intermarry, they trade, they fight, and then they transform into something else. The Nabatean kingdom was annexed by Rome in 1006 CE under Trajan, and it became the province of Arabia Petraea. But Nabatean culture didn't disappear overnight. Nabatean religion persisted for centuries. The last Nabatean inscription we found dates to around 3056 CE.
They're still writing in Nabatean in the mid-4th century, well into the Christian period.
By that point, many Nabateans had converted to Christianity. The bishopric of Petra was established by the 4th century. There were Nabatean Christians, there were Nabatean Jews, there were Nabateans who still worshipped Dushara. It was a mixed world.
Let's talk about the physical remains. Daniel mentioned a city outside Mizpah Ramon. That's Avdat. What would he have seen there?
Avdat is one of the best-preserved Nabatean cities in the Negev. It sits on a hilltop overlooking the Zin Valley, and it was a major stop on the incense route. The city was founded in the 3rd century BCE as a caravan station, basically a fortified waypoint where caravans could rest, resupply, and pay taxes. Over time, it grew into a full city with temples, houses, baths, and wine presses.
The temple to Abodas.
The temple to Abodas I, who was deified after his death. The complex includes a large platform, a portico, and ritual baths. The interesting thing is that the Nabataeans at Avdat also built a Byzantine church later, and then the site was occupied during the Islamic period. So you've got layers of Nabatean, Roman, Byzantine, and early Islamic occupation on the same hilltop. And the water system is still visible. There are channels cut into the rock on the hillside that directed rainwater into underground cisterns. Some of those cisterns are enormous, tens of thousands of liters of capacity. You can look at them today and see exactly how they worked.
The engineering is the part that stays with you. My kind of people, the Nabataeans. Slow, deliberate, building things to last.
There's a parallel there I hadn't considered. The Nabataeans were patient in a way that their rivals weren't. They didn't conquer by force of arms, mostly. They conquered by building infrastructure in places nobody else could survive, and then charging rent on the trade routes.
They were the sloths of the ancient Near East.
I'm not sure that analogy holds, but I appreciate the attempt.
What happened to them? Not the annexation, the long decline.
A few things happened simultaneously. The Roman annexation in 1006 CE turned the Nabatean kingdom into a province, which meant Nabatean elites now had incentives to Romanize. Latin and Greek became the languages of administration and prestige. The Nabatean language gradually lost ground.
The trade routes shifted.
That was the bigger factor. The Romans developed maritime routes from Egypt to India that bypassed the overland incense route entirely. Once you can ship frankincense by sea from the Red Sea to Roman ports in Egypt, you don't need to pay Nabatean caravan taxes. The economic foundation of Nabatean power eroded.
The sea route killed their business model.
It didn't kill it overnight, but it hollowed it out. The Nabatean cities in the Negev adapted. They shifted from trade to agriculture, which is when the wine production really took off, but they were no longer the indispensable middlemen. By the 4th and 5th centuries CE, the Nabatean identity was fading. People still lived in the cities, still used the water systems, still made wine. But they called themselves Romans, then Byzantines, then eventually Arabs of the Islamic conquest. The name Nabatean just stopped being used.
Assimilation by a thousand cuts.
The frankincense trade itself declined. Early Christianity was ambivalent about incense because of its association with pagan and imperial cults, though by the 4th and 5th centuries it was making its way back into Christian liturgy, especially in the East. The bigger point is that the centralized temple cult in Jerusalem, which had been a massive, concentrated consumer of frankincense, was gone after 70 CE. That was a demand shock.
The destruction of the temple didn't just change Judaism. It changed the economics of the entire region.
The temple had been the single largest consumer of frankincense in the Near East. When it was destroyed, that demand evaporated. The Nabataeans lost one of their biggest customers.
You've got Roman annexation, maritime competition, the destruction of the temple, and the gradual Christianization of the empire. Any one of those would have been survivable, all four together.
Yet the Nabataeans left a legacy that's hard to overstate. The Arabic script, the water systems, the carved facades of Petra, the agricultural techniques that made the Negev bloom. The frankincense networks that connected Arabia to the Mediterranean. and the cultural model of a trading civilization that survived not by walls and armies, but by being indispensable.
The indispensable middleman. There's a lesson there.
It's a strategy that works until it doesn't. The Nabataeans were brilliant at positioning themselves at the choke points of the ancient economy. But choke points shift. The sea route was the Nabataeans' Napster.
That's a comparison I didn't expect. The Nabataeans got disrupted.
They got disrupted by Roman logistics. The Romans figured out how to sail directly from the Red Sea to India and back using the monsoon winds, and suddenly a journey that took months overland took weeks by sea. The Nabataeans were the toll booth operators on a highway that suddenly had a bypass.
Nobody was going to take the scenic route just to keep them in business.
That's the thing about being a middleman. You don't control the product, and you don't control the customer, you control the route. And if someone finds a better route, you're finished.
Which brings us back to the religious question. Because the Nabataeans weren't just middlemen for goods, they were middlemen for ideas.
And this is where the Nabataeans become fascinating. They were a conduit for religious and cultural exchange between Arabia, the Mediterranean, and Mesopotamia. Nabataean merchants carried not just frankincense, but also stories, artistic motifs, architectural styles, and religious concepts.
You see it in the architecture at Petra. The treasury, the monastery, those facades are a mashup of Egyptian, Greek, Assyrian, and local Arabian elements.
The treasury at Petra is the perfect example. It looks Hellenistic at first glance, but the details are all wrong. The broken pediment, the tholos in the center, the relief carvings. It's a Nabataean interpretation of Hellenistic architecture, not a copy. They took what they liked from every culture they traded with and synthesized it into something distinct.
The Starbucks of the ancient world. Same menu, different country, but with a local twist.
I think that metaphor does violence to both Starbucks and the Nabataeans, but I see where you're getting at.
I'm going to take that as agreement.
The point is, the Nabataeans were cultural brokers in a way that most ancient peoples weren't. Most ancient cultures were either conquerors or conquered. The Nabataeans were connectors.
That's why they're so hard to categorize. They don't fit the usual boxes. They weren't a great empire like Rome or Persia. They weren't a prophetic civilization like Israel. They weren't a philosophical civilization like Greece. They were a commercial civilization that used cultural flexibility as a competitive advantage.
It worked for 500 years. The Nabataean kingdom lasted longer than most empires.
Longer than the Hasmoneans.
The Hasmonean dynasty lasted about 80 years as an independent state. The Nabataeans were a going concern for 4 or 5 centuries, depending on how you count.
When Daniel is standing on that hilltop near Mitzpah Ramon, he's looking at the ruins of a civilization that outlasted its rivals, built cities where nobody thought cities could exist, and then quietly dissolved into the cultures around it. Not with a bang.
Left behind an alphabet, a water system, and a temple to a deified king who beat the Maccabees. That's not a bad legacy.
What's the one thing about the Nabataeans that most people get wrong?
That they were a footnote. The Nabataeans are usually treated as a curiosity, the people who built Petra and then disappeared. But they were central to the economic and cultural history of the Near East for half a millennium. They connected Arabia to the Mediterranean. They supplied the incense that made temple worship possible, they gave us the Arabic script, and they demonstrated that a small kingdom could thrive between empires by being smarter rather than stronger.
They made wine in the desert.
They made wine in the desert on 80 millimeters of rain. That alone deserves a moment of respect.
I think about that kind of thing a lot. The civilizations that figured out how to live in places where life doesn't seem possible. The Negev isn't just dry. It's actively hostile to human settlement. And they built cities there. Not camps, not temporary shelters. Cities with temples and baths and wine presses.
The wine presses at Avdat are extensive. There's a whole industrial area. They were producing at scale. And the quality was apparently good enough that Nabataean wine was known in the Roman world. There are references in Roman sources to wine from the Petra region.
They weren't just subsistence farmers eking out a living. They were producing a luxury export in the middle of the desert.
Which tells you something about how sophisticated their water management was. You don't grow grapes for export unless you have a reliable water supply. The Nabataeans figured out how to capture and store so much water that they could afford to irrigate vineyards in a place that gets less rain than London gets in a bad month.
The Roman aqueducts are showy. Big arches, visible for miles. The Nabatean system was invisible. Channels cut into rock. Underground cisterns. Dams and wadis that looked like natural features. It was water management as camouflage.
That invisibility was a strategic asset. If you're a nomadic raider passing through the Negev, you don't see anything worth attacking. You see a dry hillside. You don't know that underneath it there's a city's worth of water.
The Nabataeans understood operational security.
They understood that in a hostile environment, being noticed is a liability. That's true in the desert, and it's true in geopolitics. The Nabataeans survived between the Seleucids, the Ptolemies, the Hasmoneans, and eventually Rome not by fighting them head-on, but by being too useful to crush and too hard to find.
The Gray Man strategy applied to an entire civilization.
It worked until Rome decided that direct administration was more efficient than a client kingdom. But even then, the annexation of Nabatea in 1060 CE was unusually peaceful. There's no record of a major Nabatean revolt against Roman rule, which is remarkable given how many other Roman annexations triggered bloody insurrections.
They negotiated the transition.
That seems to be what happened. The last Nabatean king, Rabbel II, apparently reached an accommodation with Trajan. The kingdom became a province, but the local elites kept their positions and their wealth. It was absorption, not destruction.
There's something very Nabatean about that. Why fight a war you can't win when you can negotiate terms?
Then they just kept being Nabatean, more or less, for another 2 centuries under Roman rule. The culture didn't vanish.
I want to circle back to something you mentioned earlier, about Nabatean converts to Judaism. How significant was that?
It's hard to quantify, but it was significant enough that the rabbis had to rule on it. The Talmud discusses whether Nabatean converts are to be considered fully Jewish, and the discussion assumes that such conversions were happening regularly. There were Nabatean communities in the Negev that bordered on Jewish areas, and intermarriage and conversion flowed in both directions.
The boundary between Jew and Nabatean in the first century wasn't a bright line.
It was a blurry zone, especially in the Negev and southern Transjordan, and that's important for understanding the religious landscape Daniel's asking about. When we talk about the religious groups that were in this part of the world, we tend to list them as if they were discrete categories: Jews, Samaritans, Nabataeans, Greeks, Romans. But on the ground, people moved between categories. They married across them. They adopted each other's practices.
Syncretism is the norm in history. Purity is the exception.
The Nabataeans are a great example of that. Their religion starts as Arabian polytheism, absorbs Hellenistic elements, interacts with Judaism at the borders, and eventually gets absorbed into Christianity and then Islam. At every stage, there's continuity as well as change.
The god Dushara doesn't die. He gets renamed.
Dushara becomes Zeus. Dushara then possibly gets folded into the cult of Dionysus, and eventually the temples are abandoned or turned into churches. But the sacred sites often remain the same. There's a pattern in the Negev of Nabatean temples being built on high places, and then Byzantine churches being built on the same spots. The sanctity of the place outlasts the name of the god.
That's a pattern you see everywhere. The Temple Mount in Jerusalem, the Parthenon in Athens. The Nabataeans were doing the same thing.
Sacred geography is stickier than theology. People will change what they believe before they'll change where they worship.
If you're Daniel, standing on that hilltop at Avdad, you're looking at a place that has been sacred in multiple religious traditions across 2,000 years. Nabataean temple, Byzantine church, maybe something before that. Layers of sanctity.
The frankincense that funded it all came from trees in Oman. The whole thing is a web of connections stretching from the Horn of Africa to the Mediterranean, with the Nabataeans as the spider in the center.
Don't say spider. Spiders are unsettling.
The sloth in the center.
The slow, deliberate, water-hoarding sloth in the center of the web.
I'm going to return to something I said earlier that I want to underline. The Nabataeans gave us the Arabic script. That's not a minor legacy. That's one of the most widely used writing systems on Earth, and it traces back to these frankincense traders.
Nobody learns that in school. You learn about the Phoenicians giving us the alphabet, but not the Nabataeans giving us the Arabic script.
The Phoenicians get all the credit for alphabetic writing, and they deserve a lot of it. The Nabataeans are the overlooked stepchild of the history of writing. But the Nabataean cursive that evolved into Arabic is a direct line. There are inscriptions that show the transition, late Nabataean forms that are essentially Proto-Arabic.
The Quran was written in a script that evolved from the bookkeeping of incense traders.
The word Quran itself means recitation, but the physical text was written in a script that had been developed by Nabataean scribes keeping track of frankincense shipments and tax records. The sacred and the commercial are always intertwined.
There's something almost theological about that. The medium carrying the message across centuries, across civilizations.
It's a reminder that the distinctions we draw between religious and commercial civilizations are artificial. The Nabataeans were both. Their trade was sacred and their religion was commercial. The frankincense they moved was a commodity and an offering. The script they developed was for ledgers and for prayers.
That's as good a summary as any. The Nabataeans were the people who made the sacred tradable and the trade sacred.
They built cities in the desert that still stand. Go to Avdat, go to Petra, go to Mamshit. The stones are still there, the cisterns still hold water, the wine presses are still recognizable. It's a civilization you can walk through.
The slow build, stone by stone, cistern by cistern. That's how you last.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1780s, European naturalists first documented the platypus and assumed it was a hoax stitched together from different animals, completely missing the fact that its bill contained 40,000 electroreceptors capable of detecting the faint electrical fields of prey. The real unintended consequence was that the platypus spent decades classified as a fraud rather than a biological marvel, because 18th century taxonomy had no category for a mammal that hunts by sensing electricity.
40,000 electroreceptors. That's a very specific number for a very weird animal.
The thing about the platypus is that it's proof that reality is under no obligation to be plausible.
This has been my Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtub. You can find every episode at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. If you enjoyed this, leave us a review. It helps.
Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.